of what will be seven sermons, if it all goes according to plan. So for those of you who miss during the next 7 or 8 weeks, you're just going to be out of luck, unless you want to get one of the tapes. There are seven church eras that we are very familiar with in the New Testament: Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Philadelphia, Laodicea. You all know about those. But there are also seven eras of the Old Testament, beginning with the church in the wilderness, and then of the judges, the united monarchy, the divided monarchy, and on to the other eras. There are some very interesting parallels between those church eras, not only in the Old Testament, but also in the New. The number seven is mentioned 463 times in the Scriptures. It isn't just a matter of it being completion. A number of commentaries say, well, that's a complete number. It really isn't just that. The number seven also denotes seven things that happen one after another, such as there are 7 days of creation, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are 7 days in the week. There are 7 years in the cycle of land Sabbaths. Well, the Jubilee year is 7 times 7, once every 49 years. We keep 7 days of unleavened bread. No, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are 7 annual feast days. There's the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, all the way till the 7th. The Feast of Tabernacles is in the 7th month, and there are 7 days in the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, there are many more examples in the Scriptures, such as the one question that the Pharisees asked Christ. There was a woman who had 7 husbands, you know, husband 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? But in the book of Revelation, we have the 7 seals, we have the 7 trumpets, and then they're followed by the 7 vials that are poured out on the earth. There are also 7 thunders that go one after the other. If they came all at once, it would be called one thunder. A number of times, people that are affected with leprosy are connected with the number 7. A person that was leprous in the Old Testament, in Leviticus, was told to be quarantined or go off by themselves for 7 days and then come back and show themselves to the priest. Naaman, the king, or the kind of the honor guard king of Assyria, was told by Elijah to go and dip in the Jordan River 7 times and be healed. So he was healed of his leprosy by dipping in the Jordan River 7 times. So we have the number 7 being used kind of in a sequential thing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So the idea of there being 7 church eras is not new, because it is a parallel with the way God creates. It's a parallel with the way God does things, that oftentimes these events in his plan begin with one, or the first time, and end on the 7th. Now, I want to go back to begin with to Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15. Here we have an example of Jesus Christ feeding 4,000 plus people, 4,000 men, we don't know how many women and children, which makes it a little bit difficult to determine exactly the application on some of these things. But in Matthew chapter 15, let's begin in verse 32. Jesus called his disciples to himself and said, I have compassion on the multitude because they have continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. So this group of people, thousands strong, had followed Jesus Christ and listened to him teach for 3 solid days. And they must have been hungry. Must have been somewhat thirsty. It says, they have nothing to eat. I do not want to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way. His disciples said to him, well, where can we get enough bread in the wilderness to fill such a great multitude? Now that phrase is a little flag that comes up. Where have you heard bread in the wilderness before? Well, manna. The Israelites were fed bread in the wilderness. We live in a spiritual wilderness. We're to partake of the bread of life, Jesus Christ. So the subject here is these thousands of people who are out in the wilderness and need bread. Jesus said to them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7 and a few little fish. So here are 7 loaves. Now we know from the day of Pentecost, where there were 2 loaves offered, one represented the early church, the church before Jesus Christ came, and one represents the latter church, the church after Jesus Christ came. So we know that loaves can represent these 2 dispensations or 2 time periods from which God will have people born into his family. But in this case, we have 7 loaves that would represent feeding people in the wilderness. So he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. He took the 7 loaves and the fish and gave thanks and broke them and gave them to his disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitude. So they ate and were filled, and they took up seven large baskets full of fragments that were left. So here we have 7 loaves being given to these people in the wilderness, and after that there were 7 large baskets of fragments that were left for later. Now, there have been things written, postulations about what these could represent. If we look at it from strictly the point of church eras, we could say, well, Jesus Christ fed the church in the wilderness, those 7 Old Testament eras, and they were one nation or one loaf, and so all 7 of them ate of a loaf of bread that was provided by their Creator. The 7 church eras of Revelation, which are certainly chronological and also contain lessons that apply to everybody in every era, were a mixed bag. They were Gentiles, Greeks, Romans, Israelites, lots and lots of different nationalities. They were more like a basket of fragments, and there were 7 of those. But let's go over to chapter 16 and see what Christ says about it. Verse 6, he said, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." So here's Christ and the disciples there a little while later. The disciples of the Pharisees had asked him about a sign. He said, well, all you're going to get is the sign of the prophet Jonah. Verse 7, they reasoned among themselves, saying, "It's because we have taken no bread." So Christ warned them about the leaven or the loaves of the Sadducees and Pharisees. And they reasoned and said, well, we must not have our lunch with us. He's worried about what we're going to have to eat. Jesus said, or being aware of it, said to them, "Oh, you have little faith. Why do you reason among yourselves because you brought no bread?" That's not the answer. That's not the conclusion or the lesson here. "Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of 5,000 and how many baskets you took up?" I believe that was 12 baskets of fragments in Matthew chapter 14. And then verse 12, or verse 10, "Or the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up?" So these 7 loaves that were just mentioned here in chapter 15, 4,000 people plus, how many baskets do they take up? 7. He said there's a lesson there that you ought to learn. How is it you do not understand that I not speak concerning bread, but to beware of the teaching or the leavening of the Pharisees and Sadducees? So when he fed the 5,000, later the 4,000, it represented Jesus Christ feeding them real food as opposed to them having false food or leavening from the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So they understood then, verse 12, he did not tell them to beware of leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So here in this case, we have Christ explaining that this bread, this illustration, was about being fed in the wilderness on truth as opposed to the false doctrines, false teachings others could have given them. And certainly at that time, there's going to be the time of the resurrection. There'll be a lot of people that will, I think, realize that they ate a lot of spiritual food that wasn't very good. Now, there are other parallels in the Bible. I want to go back and just look from a background standpoint at a few others. Let's begin in Genesis chapter 29. In Genesis chapter 29, sort of establish that there are a few other parallels in the Bible about there being 7 eras in the Old Testament and 7 in the New. Recall that the lives of the patriarchs and many of the people mentioned in the Scriptures, their very life, step by step, day by day, and what they did was a prophecy. Jonah's life was a prophecy. Christ quoted it as being the prophet, the sign of the prophet Jonah. But, you know, Jonah never did get up and proclaim, guess what, you know, 3 days and 3 nights, Jesus Christ will be in the grave. No, Jonah's life, the fact that he was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, was a prophecy. And as we find many of the patriarchs and what they did, going down to Egypt and coming back, and, of course, having 12 sons, sign of the 12 tribes of Israel, all these things are examples in their lives that portended what was going to happen later. In Genesis 29, beginning in verse 14, this is the case of Jacob when he finally meets Rachel and then marries Leah and Rachel. "It came to pass," well, this is verse 14, "surely Laban said to him, 'Surely you are bone of my flesh.' And he said," he stayed with him for a month. "Then Laban said to Jacob, 'Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me what your wages will be.'" So he'd been there now for a month after, of course, He had met Rachel, the daughter of Laban's mother's brother, and of course, Jacob was very excited to see Rachel. He says, well, you've been here 30 days. I can't let you just stay here and work for nothing, so what would you like to have? Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah. The name of the younger was Rachel. So in this case, there are two daughters that come into contact with Jacob. Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. So notice, Leah is the oldest. Leah is by birthright the first one to be married. She has the right to marry Jacob because of where she's born, who she is. However, Rachel is more beautiful in form and appearance and more desired by Jacob. Now, these two ladies both represent the two eras of God's church. Leah by birthright, and that's how people became part of Israel, because they were born into it in the Old Testament times. They were born as a son of one of the 12 tribes of Israel, son or a daughter, and they have the right to be called Israel. But in the New Testament, what gives us the right to be in New Testament Israel, Israel of God, is repentance, baptism, and then having God's Spirit. And so it's a matter of emotion and love. And God looks upon the heart, and those who are dedicated to God, who have gone through repentance and are seeking to follow Him, are more delicate of form and appearance from God's standpoint because God looks upon the heart. Notice verse 18. Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. So it may have been God's intent all along to have people who wanted to be a part of His family because of their conversion, because of their baptism and their spiritual change. But it was necessary to first have the early church, the church in the wilderness. It says in verse 20, Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me to wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go to her. Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. It came to the pass in the evening, he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. And Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this you've done to me? Was it not Rachel I served you for? So Leah, the one who was by birthright, legally married, did so to begin with. Jesus Christ married ancient Israel, just like Laban, or Jacob here, married this girl named Leah. But later, of course, he married, or will marry, the church he really wants to marry, the one typified by Rachel. Laban said, it is not to be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. So Leah was a wife of birthright. Rachel was a wife of desire. Remember what the Pharisee said to Christ, we are of Abraham our father. Are you greater than our father Abraham? So their opinion was that because of their birthright, they had the right to have this relationship with God. Jesus Christ said to the disciples, with desire, I desire to have this Passover with you. So with Christ, it was a matter of love. He said, love you one another. No man has greater love than this. He laid down his life for his friends. The relationship between Jesus Christ and the church that we are a part of is based on the relationship of Rachel and Jacob, one of love, one of desire, one looking on the form of appearance from the heart. So Jacob fulfilled his week, and he gave him also his daughter Rachel to heart, or to wife. So we have this example of Jacob here, and this striking parallels, and the fact that each had to be served for 7 years. There was a 7-year qualification period where his work and the passage of those time then earned the response of being able to marry that particular bride. It's like there are 7 eras in both the Old Testament and New Testament times. And the first, the Old Testament time, the church era that was in the wilderness, or began in the wilderness, was a church of birthright. It was because they were the descendants of Abraham. And they were born to Abraham, to whom God had promised this relationship. In the New Testament, we are Abraham's son because we have Jesus Christ as our father now, or as our older brother. Now let's go over to Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2. Here we have another interesting parallel. When Moses left Egypt, He was basically chased out because he killed one of the Egyptians and Pharaoh was trying to get him. I think this reenactment in the Ten Commandments movie was the poorest part of that movie. If you've seen that movie, this was probably the worst part of it. So Cecil B. DeMille had to do something to spice up some of the poor acting in the rest of the movie, and I guess he did it in this little clip. But at any rate, here we have Moses killing the Egyptian, then he goes out, and of course he sees this burning bush. But before that, he goes to Midian. Now Jethro was the priest of Midian, and Jethro was a priest of God's true worship. He later showed Aaron how to do sacrifices. He apparently kept the Passover every year. He was certainly a true worshiper of God. The true worship of God has never died out on the face of the earth since the time of Seth, even though Satan has tried to do that many times. So in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 15, Pharaoh heard of his master. He sought to kill Moses. Moses hid from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. He sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. Notice that this priest, Jethro, has seven daughters. Seven young girls, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Before, Laban only had two, because that's what Laban's daughters had to represent. But here now we have seven daughters. And we find that Moses ends up marrying one of them. But since this is the man God used to begin the seven heirs of the Old Testament church, we find that Moses didn't marry daughter number 3 or daughter number 5 or daughter number 2. He had to marry daughter number 1. Verse 21, Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. And she bore him a son. His name, of course, is Gershom. And Gershom means, I've been a stranger in a strange land. So Moses, the beginning man of the first era of the Old Testament church, married the oldest daughter of the existing worshiper of God at that time, a man named Jethro. Let's go over now to chapter 25. Exodus 25 will begin in verse 37. Not long after the Israelites came out of Egypt, we're actually leapfrogging ahead here in the story quite a ways. Moses, of course, was in the wilderness about 40 years, and he went back to Egypt at 80 years old, and then he brought the people of Israel out after all the plagues and the mighty workings of God and brought them out. So here we are a number of years later. We're going ahead about 80 years here in time. But what happened here, not 80 years, about 40, maybe 42 years in time. But at any rate, here we have the instructions from God as to what to make as furniture in the tabernacle. Here we have in verse 37 of Exodus 25, this is when Moses is up on the mount after having received the Ten Commandments. You shall make seven lamps for it. They shall arrange it, its lamps. They might give off light in front of it. So here we have these seven lamps that the previous verse says to be made of pure gold. So we have these seven candlesticks, or lampstands. Now we know very clearly in the book of Revelation that these seven lampstands in heaven, that these were identical, at least forms of, represent the seven church eras, because this says very plainly that in Revelation chapter 2. So here we have these seven lamps that were also to be in the tabernacle. The ones on the earth apparently represented the seven eras of the Old Testament church. Now notice, they had little reflectors on the back that would give light a certain direction. I don't know if you've had, your grandma had a little candle or little mirrors or whatever, little wick lamps. But on the back, they would have had the candle sticking up. They would have these golden, hammered gold plates behind them so that the light would be directed one direction. So it says, you shall make seven lamps for it, and they shall arrange its lamps, so they shall give light in front of it. Now, I'm not sure if it was seven lamps on one stand, like a menorah, where they've got the one in the middle and then the three on each side, or it was actually seven individual standing lights, seven individual standing lamps. It may have been either one. The menorah, of course, comes from Jewish tradition and from some things in archaeology from the first and second centuries, but not too much that antedates that or goes back farther than that. So we have these seven lamps, and they were built for the tabernacle in which Aaron and all of his sons would then serve. Now let's go over to chapter 29 of Exodus. And we'll find that Aaron and his sons, and all they went through, of course, were types of what Jesus Christ was going to do, Aaron being a type of Jesus Christ the high priest, or the office of the high priest, and what he did functioning, especially on the Day of Atonement, but also other days, was simply a type to teach us what Jesus Christ would later do for us, but also the sons of his, and the consecrating they would have to go through, is a type or an example of how we are to be consecrated also. Keep in mind that Jesus Christ is the firstborn of many brethren, and that we are to walk in his steps. So in chapter 29, let's start in verse 1. This is what you shall do to them to hallow them for ministering to me as priests. So the qualifications in this ceremony they would go through, so the people would then be qualified to become priests to God. Take one young bull and two young rams, or two rams, without blemish. And there's some other items here, the bread and various things. But for sake of time, let's drop down to verse 28. Actually, let's go up to verse 27. From the ram of the consecration you shall consecrate the breast of the wave offering which is waved, and the thigh of the heave offering which is raised, of that which is for Aaron and that which is for his sons. And it shall be from the children of Israel for Aaron. That's a very important verse, because it shows that this offering that would consecrate Aaron and then his sons had to be from the nation of Israel. In fact, it had to be from, in most cases, the tribe of Judah, because Jesus Christ had to be typed by this, or was typed by this, and he had to be from the tribe that God chose. The offering, Jesus Christ as our offering, could not have been a son of Japheth. He could not have been a son of Ham or Cush. He could not have been from just any tribe or any place in the earth. It had to be from the children of Israel that the offering is given. And in this case, we have simply a wave offering and also a heave offering, which is the thigh of a calf that was given in the place of Aaron. Notice it says, it is a heave offering, it shall be a heave offering from the children of Israel, from the sacrifices of their peace offerings, that is, their heave offerings to the Lord. And the holy garments of Aaron shall be his sons after him. So to begin with, they made these white garments for Aaron, and he wore them. The only thing that was not white was this breastplate that hung on a gold chain over his neck. The breastplate had the 12 stones of Israel and the little pockets that had the Urim and Thummim in them. But then those white clothing, the white wrap and the tunic and all that, was handed down to Aaron's sons. Just like what we have now is the righteousness of Jesus Christ living in us. Paul said the great mystery was Christ living in us, not just ourselves living alone. So we have this, at least parallel, it's something to teach us about how Jesus Christ's righteousness is then passed down because he is the firstborn of many brethren. Verse 30, that son who becomes a priest in his place shall put them on for 7 days. So this time of trial, 7 days, time of showing that he could wear white garments. A number of the prophecies in Revelation 2 and 3 about church eras talk about putting on white garments, talk about washing and having their garments washed in white. Because those eras are times when people have an opportunity to then have the white garments of Jesus Christ put on them, the garments of righteousness. So we have this parallel also in the 7 days that it takes to qualify to become a priest. It's like there are 7 eras of the church when people can have time to qualify to become priests in God's family. So let's drop down to verse 35. Thus ye shall do to Aaron and his sons, according to all that I have commanded you, 7 days you shall consecrate them. So it took 7 days to set them apart and have everyone then acknowledge that they were now a priest working in the temple of God. Let's go over now to Leviticus chapter 4 and verse 1. Leviticus chapter 4 and verse 1. Here we have where the priest, if there was a sin to be atoned for, would sprinkle some blood from a sin offering 7 times towards God's throne, towards the throne there in the tabernacle. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 1, speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally against any of the commandments of the Lord, in anything which ought not to be done, and does any of them, if the anointed priest sins, bringing guilt upon the people, then let him offer to the Lord for his sin, which he has sinned, a young bull without blemish, as a sin offering. This is a reminder of their sins, as it says back in Hebrews. He shall bring the bull to the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord, lay his hand on the bull's head, and kill the bull before the Lord. Then the anointed priest shall take some of the bull's blood and bring it to the tabernacle of meeting, so a small little vial or bowl wasn't much. The priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle some of the blood 7 times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. So put his finger in the bowl, you know, spread, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 drops of blood. Notice verse 7, the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of sweet incense before the Lord. Now that altar is mentioned several times in Revelation as symbolizing these prayers of God's saints that have gone up all through the centuries as they have been persecuted and as they have been hurting and been crying out for God's help. So these, you know, this horn of these altars, this altar with the horns, is mentioned in context with the eras of the New Testament church. And so perhaps this sprinkling of blood 7 times, you know, is simply one more way of there being a parallel and a symbol of the 7 eras or 7 times when the blood of Jesus Christ is available for people then to have that applied to them and have their sins removed. So the priest then puts his blood or some of the blood on the horns of the altar while that sweet incense that symbolizes our prayers goes up from before God, symbolizing God seeing the blood of Jesus Christ while he listens to our prayers for our deliverance and forgiveness. Then let's go over to Leviticus chapter 23. We mentioned briefly about the 7 holy days of unleavened bread, or the 7 days of unleavened bread, the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles. There's an early 7 days, and there's a later 7 days followed by the 8th. Just another simple parallel, there is an earlier 7 eras of the church in the wilderness and a later 7 eras of God's church, spiritual Israel, followed by the last great day, the time when all of mankind will have their chance as they come out of the graves. Leviticus 23 in verse 6 simply says, on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. So for 7 days, we would keep the days of unleavened bread. We just finished that last week. And so each day was to build on the previous day as we learned the lesson of putting sin out and of partaking of Jesus Christ, who is our unleavened, perfect Savior, perfect offering for us. And down the same chapter, but verse 34, talks about the Feast of Tabernacles. Speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of this 7th month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles to the Lord for 7 days. So there's day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And after that, of course, verse 36, on the 8th day, the day after that church era, there is this holy convocation made with fire, a sacred assembly. So just as a parallel, there is the earlier 7 days in the year, then later there's the later 7-day feast, followed by an offering day, an 8th day. And of course, after the 7 eras of the church, we have the time of the millennium, and then after that, the time when all mankind can eventually have their chance to understand God's truth. Well, now I want to go through some comparisons, but first, I want to give you some statistics. From Revelation chapter 2, verse 1 to chapter 3 and verse 22. In this breakdown of the 7 churches, which we understand very clearly as being both chronological and every era applying to all of us, because it says very plainly, he who has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So every one of these eras contains powerful lessons for each one of us, but they also give us some lessons and parallels from history. And in fact, the events that occurred in each one of these eras in the New Testament times are strikingly similar to the events that occurred to their comparable era in the Old Testament times, the earlier dispensation. Just from Revelation chapter 2 and 3, there are 23 descriptions of Jesus Christ, 4 items of what God has done or will do, 32 good things, 14 items of general information, 23 bad things, 6 items that shall happen, 21 items of advice on what to do, 6 reasons to follow God's advice, 11 warnings, 2 ifs, 3 promises, 2 items of what Jesus is doing, and 22 rewards. Now, that's a lot for just a chapter and a half. Also, if you look at an overview of the 7 churches from best to worst, this is a little bit difficult because it gets a little bit subjective, but obviously number 6, the Philadelphia church, is a church of brotherly love and would have to top the list of being the best of the 7. Smyrna, number 2, the church of martyrdom, persecution, and poverty, would be 2nd. Ephesus would be 3rd. The early church, desirable, but they left their first love. Then Pergamos, they had problems with the world infiltrated the church, they had mixed doctrines. In Thyatira, continual sacrifice. with more ungodly doctrines. Sardis, the dead church, simply virtually died out. Only a few that were not defiled. And then finally, Laodicea, the church of lukewarmness that is spewed out. We find that the spiritual decline of the church began as soon as the deception set in. Historically speaking, that's what caused it. To begin with, of course, the first era is the era of Ephesus. It's a time when Jesus Christ had just begun the church in 31 A.D. until about the year 155 A.D., which would be the time of the death of Polycarp. Now, let me go through some more kind of survey things here. The first church in Ephesus, the city Ephesus means desirable, and they came out with a very strong desire. The city of Ephesus was desired as a large commercial center. When the city of Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 A.D. by the Roman general Titus, by that time the church that had been headquartered there had escaped over to a place called Pella, and while many of them returned, the actual apostleship of the church moved up to Ephesus, which is where John apparently lived for many years, and later, of course, there were other places on Asia Minor, the coast of Asia Minor, but essentially Ephesus was the place, what would be called the center of the Church of God as we know it, from about the year 80 to about the year 155. Now, Ephesus had a temple of Artemis called that of the Ephesians, one of the ancient wonders of the ancient world. It was a great port city, had lots of temples and lots of seats of government there, but it was destroyed in 262 by an earthquake and never was completely rebuilt, later taken over by Arabs, Turks, and finally the Mohammedans in about 1403. So John writes to them, writes to this angel at the church of Ephesus. Let's go back first to Revelation chapter 2. I'll just kind of read through this, and then we'll go back and look at some parallel events in the Old Testament chronology of the church in the wilderness and the New Testament record of the Ephesian era of God's church. In Revelation chapter 2, in verse 1, to the angel or the messenger of the church of Ephesus, write. So when John wrote this, this is interesting, when John wrote this in about 90 A.D., along in the 90s A.D., Ephesus would have been his headquarters. It's almost like he's writing to himself. There would be other ministers there, of course, but this would be a church and a local area that he would have known about very well. Now, he's writing from Patmos, so he's in prison or in exile. Later, of course, he was let out and had a number of years before he died. These things says, he who holds the seven stars in his right hand, stars normally typify angels or representatives. Certainly they can typify these messengers or angels of each one of these church eras. They are in the hand of God. On his right hand, who walks in the midst of the seven golden lampstands. So in this case, we have these seven lampstands mentioned, and Jesus Christ is walking in amongst them. So he is there among these seven eras. The seven eras of the New Testament church typify these lampstands of the Old Testament, typified by the menorah or the lampstands that were in the tabernacle. I know your works, your labor and your patience. So they had worked very hard. They had spread the gospel throughout the known world the best they could. They endured persecutions. Now, in the Old Testament chronology, the church in the wilderness worked very hard to take the promised land under Joshua. They had a lot of military campaigns. They had spied things out. They, of course, spent 40 years in the wilderness and about another 40 to 60 spying out the promised land and taking it with battles and trying to establish themselves. Never did quite finish the job, just like the job of establishing the church as it should have been under the Ephesian era was never quite completed because of the challenges that they faced. It says, I know your works, your labor and patience, that you cannot bear those who are evil. Now, they lived among much pagan idolatry. The entire Roman and Greek world were full of statues, all sorts of Diana the Ephesians and Zeus and Apollos and all the various ones. The church did not get involved with idolatry. But what happened was men who taught evil infiltrated their way into the church, and then they had to be tested by the people who were there, the church leaders who were there. Just like in the church coming out of Egypt, there was a mixed multitude, and there were a number of ideas from Balaam and others that came in, and they, of course, had to be tested by the true Israelites to find them what whether or not they were liars or tellers of the truth. So it says, you cannot bear those who are evil. You have tested those who say they are apostles and are not, and found them liars. So there were some people claiming to be teachers, claiming to be apostles. They had to be tested whether or not they were telling the truth. So we have some interesting parallels there. But then it says, you have persevered and have patience. And they certainly did that in the patience, in the face of a lot of persecution from Rome, from Roman agents, from Jews, people like the Apostle Paul, Timothy, the other apostles, you know, one by one went out to the world in various places and through great struggles and great tribulations preached and established congregations of God's church throughout the known world. It says, you have labored for my name's sake and have not become weary. Nevertheless, I have this against you. You have left your first love. Now, what does that mean, they left their first love? Did they lose their zeal for preaching the gospel, for establishing new churches, for going out to various places, travel? I don't think that's what it means as much as they began to get involved in all sorts of crazy ideas. Gnosticism, ideas of their Jesus Christ being a phantom instead of a real being. There were a real host. It was a real host of false ideas that came in. Of course, Simon Magus would have been the leading person who was a liar that was tested and was found not to be an apostle and was kicked out. We have examples of that in the book of Acts. But there were others who came in who were successful at teaching deception and teaching doctrines that were wrong. And so Paul warns often about not getting involved in endless genealogies and fables and little things that were sidetracking people. And so these people, this era, became bogged down, not because of the persecutions and outside influences, but because of all these ideas and all these little things that distracted them from their first focus of repentance and conversion and the kingdom of God and all those things Christ taught that they had when they first began to learn. He says, remember then, therefore, from where you have fallen. Repent and do the first works. Come back to that feeling that you had in the time in the book of Acts, when there were thousands baptized, when there was all of this excitement about Jesus Christ's return. He says, or else I will come to you quickly and remove your lampstand from its place, unless you repent. So they had to remove the lampstand from its place, or it would have been removed if they didn't repent. But this you have, you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. The Nicolaitans, I think we can tie their doctrines very clearly into the idea of Simon Magus and what he taught with the teachings that came from Egypt that eventually became the great church of Europe and the true church of God. Those people did not tolerate that. They basically put him out and rejected his teachings. So the Nicolaitans and his teachings and deeds eventually, of course, became St. Nicholas. I always thought it was interesting that St. Nicholas here is mentioned as something God hates, but then people celebrate him once a year with saying he has reindeer and brings gifts. But, you know, who am I to judge? if they want to read that and do it, that's fine with me. At any rate, this Nicolaitan idea, obviously, I think we can historically tie very carefully to Simon Magus, and we have ample evidence that the apostles did not tolerate him but put him out. So he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, because all of these dangers of losing your first love, of having the Nicolaitan's doctrine, all of those things are with us today. To him who overcomes, which really means wins the battle or finishes the race, I will give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. So these people left their first love, but at least they had among them a number of people who held fast and did not tolerate some of these false ideas that came along. Now, I want to do some comparisons now. Let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning in verse 1. Here we find that Moses told the people, just as they were preparing to go into the promised land, that they were a holy people and that they were to do some very special things concerning their example in the world. Deuteronomy chapter 28, in verse 1, it says, it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above nations on the earth. All these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. It talks about the blessings of the fruit of their body, of the increase of their cattle and of their herds, of their basket and kneading bowl. Then he says, verse 9, the Lord will establish you as a holy people to himself. just as he has sworn to you, if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways, then all the peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. Now Jesus Christ later said to be the light of the world, like a city set upon a hill, or a candle or a lamp set upon a hill. He said here that other peoples would see what kind of nation they were, and would see that example, and would fear them. Let's go now to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, where here the New Testament church is also called a holy people, or a special called out group. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. You are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, very identical phraseology to what Moses was using, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Now, the way you proclaim the praises of God is to live according to his laws, live according to this book. That'll be an example that other people will see. It doesn't just mean you're out there preaching and talking and they can hear your words all the time. So we have the example of this holy people that was given both to the people coming out of the wilderness, the church in the wilderness, and also this early New Testament era of the church. Now let's go over to Exodus chapter 32. And we find that what is so interesting is that these people also left their first love very quickly. They very quickly turned away from that excited feeling they had coming out of Egypt. That it's almost baffling to us, but yet we find in the New Testament that other people had very quickly began following a false gospel. Just like here, they went to worshiping the golden calf. So in Exodus 32 and verse 1, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. We don't know what happened to old Moses. Good old Moses is gone." So Aaron then, of course, said, "Break off your earrings and I'll make you this golden calf." So very quickly, after they came out of Egypt, we're only talking, 35, 36 days perhaps from when they left the land of Egypt. Now let's go back over to Galatians chapter 1. We find in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul wrote and said, "I'm just amazed that you are very quickly going to a different gospel." How is it that the early era, the first era of the church, having been so many years close to the actual events of Jesus Christ living on the earth, of the miracles he performed, of his sacrifice that was very well known, the crucifixion, how could they only 20 or 30 years later be following a different gospel? It doesn't make any sense. But neither did it make any sense that the people who are of the Ephesian era of the Old Testament, how they could possibly go back to worshiping the golden calf only, a few weeks after coming out of the land of Egypt. Galatians chapter 1 and verse 6, "I marvel that you are turning away so soon from him who called you into the grace of Jesus Christ to a different gospel." So Paul just shook his head, rolled his eyes. "I'm marveling that you are turning to a different gospel so soon, which is not another, that there are some who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you than that which we have preached to you, let him be accursed." And so there was this very quick leaving on the part of some people of the true gospel and going to something that was different. Let's go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, just back a few pages. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, we find that Paul talks about the same thing to the people in Corinth. So the record we have of the Ephesian era of the New Testament is that, yes, they did leave their first love. Some left it pretty quickly. Now, there may have been some reasons for that. First, let's read 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 4. "If he who comes preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit, which you have not received, or a different gospel, which you have not accepted, you may well believe it, may well put up with it." So here Paul says, look, all these people are out there preaching different things. And of course, in Corinth, he'd written to them about those who preached Apollos, those who preached Paul, those who preached Peter, and dividing up in factions. Now, as we look back on the early New Testament church, we have to consider that, to begin with, they started with a very high hand. And you can compare this events that are given to us in Acts 2 and 3, where we have thousands of people baptized, 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people a day, and they all stayed in Jerusalem. They sold their possessions. They shared things in common. It was a very exciting time. Now, they did that because they thought Jesus Christ was coming real soon. They thought, why should I go back to Carthage? I'll just stay here in Jerusalem, and Christ's going to come back here in a few weeks. They'd probably sit there on a hilltop and watch the sky. They probably even had round-the-clock, you know, sky watchers waiting for the return of Christ. And, of course, it didn't happen. So after a few weeks, what happened? Well, they start arguing. Well, your widows are getting more money than my widows, or your people are getting more food than my people. So they had to appoint deacons to take care of all this, you know, food on the table stuff, because as time went on, Christ didn't come. Now, in the church in the wilderness, they came out of Egypt with a high hand, and they pretty much thought they were going to take, you know, I-5 and all their fast cars right into the promised land. They didn't want to spend 40 years in the wilderness. So after they were found to be sinning, and Christ or God said, you can't go into the wilderness for 40 years, they, of course, got mad and tried to anyway. But here they were sitting out there in the wilderness just wanting to go in. And, of course, what happened? They started arguing. They started having difficulties. They started having heresies. They started having men who wanted to have a following after themselves. So the parallel of the early record and the later record, the parallels are somewhat similar, because both thought they would go to the promised land very quickly, you know, a few days, a few weeks, a few months. When it didn't happen, then they had to begin setting up organization and structure. And Moses, of course, had a father-in-law who said, well, set up captains of 100, captains of 1,000, captains of 50, and they handle all the easy questions. You just do the real tough things. And, of course, then they had the priesthood set up various things. In the New Testament church, the apostles had to begin organizing churches, begin organizing speakers, begin organizing how things were going to go, because they were not going to go into the promised land very fast. Jesus Christ was not coming very soon. So because of that delay, there were then dangers. Dangers of false gospels, dangers of a false teacher, and of course, dangers of men who want to promote themselves. Let's go back to Numbers chapter 16. Numbers chapter 16. Now, in this case, it's a very famous chapter. Mr. Armstrong quoted this chapter quite often as he dealt with certain rebellions in the church and parallel events, or he thought were parallel. But it wasn't just one man. Sometimes we read this story or we discuss the story of Korah, and we kind of consider him as being the rebel in the wilderness. But what's the most amazing thing about the book of Numbers is that there are more people alive at the beginning of the book than are numbered at the end of the book. There is a net loss. There were so many rebellions and times that God had to deal with them by killing some, by having disease come rampant through the camp of Israel, and all these people dying, that there actually are fewer people alive 40 years later than there were those that were alive to begin with, because in Numbers, the people are numbered twice. So this shows you that these people had a tough time in the wilderness, that they just had a difficult time getting along, a difficult time dealing with each other, a difficult time learning to follow God, just had a difficult time with their human nature. So Numbers chapter 16 and verse 1, it says, Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, he was a Levite, son of Levi. This guy would have been, quote, a minister by birth. With Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. So here's three guys now, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And on the sons of Peleth and sons of Reuben, other men. So here we have at least 5, 6, 7, 8 men now who are involved in this rebellion. They rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. So what did these men want? Well, they wanted to be the big guys. They wanted to be in power. They wanted to have title, status, perhaps tithe money. Although they would have had that already, being Levites, at least some of them. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy. Every one of them. Now that's true, we're all a holy priesthood, we're all holy followers of God, but not everybody is called to be in the ministry of God, not everybody was called to be a Levite, or born as a Levite. So here we have them saying very plainly, you take too much upon yourself, everybody's holy, you know, why are you thinking you should be the top guys? Why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the congregation? Thankfully, Moses didn't even answer that ridiculous accusation. But the same thing occurred in the New Testament very quickly. Let's go over to Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20, beginning in verse 28. What we find here is that Paul knew that men after the spirit of Korah and all of his followers were already in among the people of the church of God very early on in its history. Acts chapter 20, we'll begin in verse 28. Here he's leaving. It's interesting because this took place at Ephesus. He's saying goodbye to the elders of Ephesus, and Ephesus would later become the, quote, headquarters of that time, and would then be the example church for that entire era, the first era of the church. So it's a sort of a neat coincidence, perhaps it isn't a coincidence, that this happens at Ephesus. Verse 28, "Therefore take heed to yourselves and to all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers to shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. For I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock." So he knew there would be false teachers coming in among them. "Therefore watch and remember that for 3 years I did not cease to warn everyone day and night with tears." So here we have Paul saying very plainly, as soon as I leave, there are going to be these false teachers rising up, not sparing the flock, but wanting to have fellowship after themselves. The same thing as Korah and the others back in the book of Numbers. Let's go over to 2 Peter chapter 2. Many examples of this, especially as the New Testament era, the first era of the New Testament, came towards its middle and final years, that it was replete with men wanting to have a following after themselves. That the church wasn't necessarily destroyed by false doctrine, by idolatry, by the teaching of the Roman world around them, but it was certainly infected by men who wanted to have preeminence among the brethren, who wanted to have a position that they would then be looked to. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 1, "There were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you." So Peter's telling them, look, there were false prophets back there at that time. There will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. So here we have Peter saying very plainly, look, there's going to be false teachers and destructive heresies in our group. Many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth has been blasphemed. By covetousness, they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time, their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. So he knew there would be an eventual punishment. But he said, these people are already working very hard among the group. Let's go down to 3 John, verse 9. Now, these later writings of John, probably John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Revelation are the last six books, the last five books written in the New Testament chronicle. And we find here that this problem is rampant. The problem of men like Korah and others wanting to have a following after themselves. 3 John, verse 9. "I wrote to the church," somebody, this was the Jerusalem church, we don't know, "but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among us, does not receive us." In other words, he was even putting people out who were really converted members of the church, because he wanted to have preeminence. So we have this guy named Diotrephes. His name is almost now a type of a label, so to speak, like the name, you know, Rasputin and others, where their virtual name now has become a descriptive adverb or descriptive adjective of people. We call an individual a Diotrephes. So he loves to have preeminence among the brethren. Just go back over one page to 2 John, verse 7. "Many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh." So we still have that today. We have people who don't think Jesus Christ really was God, or that he was later created, or some other fiction. "This is a deceiver and an antichrist." So we have evidence that much that was happening back then happened later. "Look to yourselves. We do not lose those things that we worked for." In other words, contend for the faith once delivered. The warning from John to his people is, look to yourselves. Look at the truth you once learned, and don't lose it. Don't lose that first love, as it says in the book, or in the church era of Ephesians. "But we may receive a full reward." Down in verse 10, "If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, don't receive him into your house or greet him." So the parallel between the book of Numbers and the New Testament account is one that's very, very interesting, one that's pretty striking, in fact. Now let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 31. Deuteronomy chapter 31. We find that Moses predicted that after his death, and after the time when his influence was no longer there, that the people of Israel would turn aside from God's commandments, and they would then have a new way of doing things that would be wrong. Deuteronomy chapter 31, beginning in verse 16. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, you will rest with your fathers, and this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods and the foreigners of the land, where they go to be among them, and they will forsake me and break my covenant which I have made." He said, look, I know they're going to do it as soon as you're gone. Let's drop down now to chapter, or the same chapter, but verse 29. I know that after my death, Moses is telling the people, he gathered all the elders of the tribes together, after my death you'll become utterly corrupt and turn aside from the way that I have commanded you. Evil will befall you in the latter days, because you'll do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger through the works of your hands. So they admitted there would be evil in the last days after they left. After Moses would die, then people would begin to fall apart spiritually. Let's go over now to the final record of the church in the wilderness, Joshua chapter 24. Because this group of people did a lot of physical work. They spread throughout the land of Canaan. They took to the borders almost of the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates. Not quite, but they took a lot of the land. They divided up the cities in the land among the families of Israel. They did not quite complete the job. There are many references in Joshua that show they didn't completely kick out the Canaanites that they should have done. But they did do a good work. They did do much that God would be proud of them for doing because they followed him, much like in the church era of Ephesians, the first era. They also spread throughout the known world and preached the gospel. But here in Joshua chapter 24, Joshua gathers, verse 1, all the tribes of Israel to Shechem. That's where the original covenant had been made, you know, with Jacob. And called for the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, their officers, and they presented themselves before God. And he gave a long history here of how God called Abraham, and how they were later in Egypt, how they were brought out of Egypt with a high hand, and how they had been in the wilderness for 40 years, how God then brought them into this land. Then he says in verse 15, if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, meaning the river of Egypt, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. The people answered and said, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord and serve other gods. But of course, we know that's what they did. Verse 21, the people said to Joshua, but no, we will serve the Lord. However, in the book of Judges, verse 1, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, who shall fight for us? And of course, before long, people began to follow different ideas. Joshua chapter 24 and verse 31 says, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done in Israel. After that, they began then to worship the gods of the land around them. Let's go over to Jude chapter 3, just before the book of Revelation. Jude chapter 3. Jude verse 3 is only one chapter. The lesson of the first church era, both in the wilderness and in the book of Revelation, the lesson of the Ephesus church era is that we should contend for the faith once delivered to the saints. Because there will be false teachers that will come in. There will be periods of patience where we would like Christ to return immediately, but he chooses to delay. You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, none of us would have predicted that we would be here in the year 2004, at least not in this situation. So I'm kind of glad we are. You know, I heard this morning, believe it or not, I called my dad. He's 81 years old. Last week, he was in a golf tournament and got his fifth hole in one. Now, can you imagine that? I mean, most people play golf all their life and never get a hole in one. My dad at 81 years old, the oldest, second oldest player in the entire tournament down there in that part of Florida. You know, official tournament play, got a hole in one again, his fifth one. So I was proud, glad my dad did that. I mean, I realize that hitting little white balls doesn't really accomplish much when it comes to spiritual things, but I just thought I'd encourage Mr. Gunderson that, you know, my dad's 6 years older than he is, five and a half, and he's hitting holes in one. So, you know, there's hope. It's kind of like we hunters say, you know, as long as there's lead in the air, there's hope. I'm just kidding. I know you're getting tired, so I wanted to wake you up a little bit. But I really was proud of my father, and, you know, it's just kind of neat that he's able to still do that and have something that really makes his life, you know, exciting and enjoyable. But let's look here at Jude, verse 3. Beloved, I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation. I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. That's the lesson we have to learn from studying everything from the first era of the Old Testament, the church in the wilderness, as it's called in Acts 7, and the first era of Ephesians, that we had better be very sure and careful in our life to contend for the first truth, the faith that was first delivered to us. And next time we'll go into the church of Smyrna and learn some lessons from that.